Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today, on the second ever episode of The Charlie Kirk Show from Podcast One, we lay some philosophical foundations for the direction and future of this show, why I believe what I believe, and why I think you should too. We also deep dive into who I believe are the top 2020 candidates for the Democrats. And finally, I want to issue a few bold predictions for the presidential elections you won't hear anywhere else. This is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show. Before we get into it, getting fit and staying healthy always sounds easier said than done, right? OpenFit is bringing you something new that makes it even easier to never miss a workout. Lose the commute to the gym and let the workouts come to you. OpenFit takes all of the complexity out of losing weight and getting fit. It's a brand new, super simple streaming service. I honestly just promoted it the other day. It's really amazing. I'm always traveling. I'm traveling 340 days a year. I'm using it with some of my stretches. I'm actually recuperating from a back injury right now. So I have some of the yoga and some of the stretches that are in there. I was running all the time and working out. Once on my road to recovery, OpenFit is going to help me get there, I'll tell you right now. All out of the comfort of my living room or my hotel room, wherever it might be. There's amazing trainers and classes, interactive, so you're able to actually get coaching, you're able to get encouragement while you're doing it. It's really, really simple. The app is easy to use. You just understand it as soon as you open it. Access it anywhere at any time. View on your computer. It's web-enabled TV, tablet, smartphone, and Roku. Its results you can see. You can track it. You can set goals. Lose up to 15 pounds in just the first 30 days. Flatten your abs and shape your body. Look and you'll feel great. And I'll tell you, again, for the stretching and things that I'm doing, it keeps me disciplined. I get alerts. I get push notifications. It keeps me accountable. It allows me to do the type of workouts that I need to do on my personal road to recovery and eventually be able to work out the way that I used to. So OpenFit has just changed the way I've worked out. With my promo code Kirk, that is K-I-R-K, you can join me on a fitness journey personalized just for you. Again, use my code Kirk, K-I-R-K, and start using OpenFit for your journey to start a healthier life. Right now, during the OpenFit 30-Day Challenge, my listeners get a special extended 30-day trial membership to OpenFit, where you can lose up to 15 pounds in 30 days when you text Kirk, K-I-R-K, to 303030. Again, that's 303030. That's three 30s in a row. You'll get access to OpenFit, all the workouts and nutrition information totally free. Again, just text Kirk, K-I-R-K, to 303030. Standard message and data rates may apply. So again, welcome everybody. What a great week our show was last week. I just want to say we launched so amazingly. I just want to thank everyone that helped subscribe to our podcast, helped give us those 5-star ratings. If you're listening to this and you're one of those 1-star ratings, I want to thank you for that too, because at least it counted as a rating. But anyway, we are off to a huge start. We were in the top 15 of all podcasts. I just want to thank Donald Trump Jr. and Kimberly Guilfoyle for that amazing, candid, and deep conversation. I consider Don a good friend and a close friend, and he really does not get the credit that he deserves for the passion and the patriotism that he shows for our country. I have traveled the country all over. I've been to over 30 states with him, from Iowa to Montana to Florida to California, doing grassroots events, doing college campus events. Donald Trump Jr. is one of the unsung heroes of this administration. He cares so deeply about our country. He draws massive crowds. And for him to take his time to be able to go in the grassroots to college campuses for Turning Point USA is absolutely amazing. And I do have to say, quick sorry to anyone that had issues with the sound quality. The Secret Service kind of put us in some form of a bunker, but it was still a lot of fun. And honestly, thank you again to Donald Trump Jr. and Kimberly Guilfoyle for that just amazing conversation. It just skyrocketed this show to the top right out of the gates. But we're going to keep it going. And I want to start this show how we're going to be doing a lot of shows, which is kind of the news of the week, talking about the 2020 cycle. But even before we get into those things, I want to take a step back and give everyone listening an idea of why I believe what I believe, what I believe, how I got there, and who I am. So I am these things in this order. First and foremost, I'm a Christian, then I'm an American, and then I'm a conservatarian. What do those things mean? Well, first of all, I'm a Christian. So I'm going to tell you what kind of Christian I am and what a Christian is, because if you're listening to this, I guarantee a lot of people listening have misconceptions or misnomers of what a Christian actually is. So a Christian is someone who believes in the Bible, 66 books, 35 authors, believes it's the greatest book ever to exist in the history of the world, the most powerful book, the most duplicated book, the most translated book, the most influential book, but it's also, interestingly enough, the most banned book, the most burned book, and the most banished book in human history. By any objective measure, it has been the most influential book in human history. So a Christian is someone who believes in the authenticity and the divinity of the Bible. But most importantly, the question, the most important question for Christians is this: who is Jesus Christ? Who is Jesus Christ? Was he just another historical figure? Was he someone that was influential in the Middle East region? Was he someone that was really charismatic? Or was he what I believe he is and was and continues forever, the Son of God, as the God in three parts, the Holy Trinity? And this question of who is Jesus Christ, we as Christians believe, is the most important question that any human being can answer. Now, if you believe he's a historical figure, that's perfectly a respectable position. But we as Christians believe there's something more divine. There's something deeper about Jesus Christ. And this is illustrated in the authenticity and the divinity of the Bible, in the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, four separate accounts written by four different authors a couple decades apart, writing about the life, the works, the miracles, and the lessons of Jesus Christ. And so we as Christians don't just believe in this in a evidentiary way, understanding that there are four different accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, talking about the same things most of the time, written from four different authors in the same region. But we also believe this in an experiential way, that if you are born again and you accept Jesus Christ into your life, that something happens to you, something metaphysical happens to you and something spiritual happens to you, where you are reborn, you are born new. And as a Christian, we believe it's so important, the idea of redemption and of forgiveness and the passage that we're all broken people. This is so fundamental, and everything that guides my life and everything that guides my politics starts from the idea that we are broken people and that we are flawed from our birth and upon creation. Now, I will get into a little bit that I actually don't, my politics by definition, I'm very careful not to have my religious views and my faith inform my political decisions. And I'll explain exactly what I mean by that. So I'm a Christian. Now, I'm also an American. What does that mean? Well, I believe America is the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. I see such concerning rise of anti-Americanism in our country. It seems that there's members of Congress that say more negative things about America than positive things about America. Now, is America a perfect country? Absolutely not. Of course not. We had slavery at one point. Women couldn't vote. There are still huge systemic problems in our country, but we are the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. We're the most benevolent. We're the most generous. We're the most charitable. We're the most accepting. We're the most productive. For example, we bring in half of the world's immigrants every single year. America brings in half of the world's immigrants every single year. And yet we get mislabeled by many people as somehow falling into this trap and this lie that we're bigoted and we're racist and we're homophobic. Nothing could be further from the truth. We bring in 1 million people voluntarily into our country every single year. We're by far the most benevolent and charitable country ever to exist. Americans voluntarily gave away $500 billion to charity last year. $500 billion. That's outside of taxes. That's outside of government programs. And I make the argument that the best way to help the least of these, and we should care about helping the least of these, people that really are struggling, people that need a hand up, is through churches and synagogues and mosques and community centers, not through government programs and checks from the federal government. That actual charitable institutions, individuals helping individuals, is the most moral and effective way to actually help people. But, and I'm going to get into the later in the show kind of what the foundational ideas of America actually are. But I label myself as a proud American because what's so unique about being an American is, unlike any other country in the world, despite your race, your religious background, or where you come from, if you come to America and you embrace our core ideas and our core values, you then become an American. Very other countries have that. If you come from anywhere across the world and you go to Germany, they don't view you as German unless you're quote-unquote ethnically German. America, that you are viewed as an American if you believe in the ideas. And I think this is best illustrated in the 2016 women's gymnastics team. The women's gymnastics team won gold. In the women's gymnastics team, you had four young ladies that all were Americans, but they were a very diverse group. You had a Hispanic American, you had a Black African American, you had a Jewish American, and a Caucasian American. And we viewed that team all as Americans, and this was the best representation of our success and the highest level of accomplishment. But they were competing against the Chinese. And you looked at the Chinese, they were all ethnically Chinese, all four. Now, the difference is that as American, look how diverse the backgrounds are, yet we all equally consider each one of the members of the female gymnastics team as American. Now, if any one of the American members of the gymnastics team, for example, the Hispanic American young lady, would have been put on the Chinese team, they would not have considered that person to be Chinese. This is so unique about what it means to be an American and how lucky we are to live in a country that embraces these ideas. And we'll get into that in a second. Then finally, I'm a conservatarian. Well, what does that mean? Well, it's kind of a blend of a conservative libertarian. Essentially, is the idea that you can do what you want to do with your life as long as it doesn't harm somebody else. It's the idea that, yes, government does have a necessary and proper role, first and foremost, to provide for the national defense, to have a strong military, to provide for the safety of its people. I do believe in a police force, but I believe right now, as it stands, we have far too much government in our life. Government is reaching way too far into the citizens' lives. As one of my heroes say, Dennis Prager always says, the larger the government, the smaller the citizen. We have more government bureaucracies than we know what to do with. We have millions of people working in Washington, D.C., where their sole purpose is to do nothing but to regulate and to tax and to litigate and make the lives of the American people harder and more difficult and more cumbersome. So as a conservatarian, every day I try to wake up, I try to educate people to try to increase the freedom and liberty of all people, to try to scale back the size and scope of government so that individuals can flourish and prosper. And this is fundamental to my worldview, is that the individual matters. And you actually go back to some of the foundational philosophy that founded America. If you look at the difference between the French Revolution and the difference between the American Revolution, the difference between the American Revolution and the French Revolution is fundamentally the American Revolution was inspired by the thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment. It was inspired by the thinkers such as John Locke or Hume that believed in the sovereignty of the individual, of that individuals should be able to express themselves as they see fit, that people should be able to live free outside of a cumbersome government. Also in the Scottish Enlightenment was Adam Smith, who, interestingly enough, wrote his book, The Inquiry into the Cause of the Wealth of Nations. And I'm paraphrasing the title here, but it's something along those lines, Inquiry into the Wealth of Nations, in guess what year? 1776, the very same year that the Declaration of Independence was written. What a year for liberty, right? You have the Wealth of Nations written, and you also have the Declaration of Independence written. Now, I'm going to get later into this show or in future shows talking about the importance of the title of the Wealth of Nations, because understand, the title is actually the main point of the book. Adam Smith was so curious of why certain countries are richer than other countries, as why certain countries create wealth and why certain countries are prospering more than others. He was actually going on a discovery mission. He considered himself almost a private investigator into going into why are markets working in certain areas and why are certain people living in poverty. But you juxtapose the American Revolution with the French Revolution. Now, the American Revolution was based on Scottish Enlightenment ideas, which is nothing more than just a collision with destiny of thinkers that were able to challenge the status monolithic quo that individuals don't have to live on a farm their whole life and that they can be free and they can exist in a market economy. The founding fathers took these ideas, they rebelled against a monarchy, and they eventually implemented them in the greatest political document ever written, which is the United States Constitution. The French Revolution was fundamentally different. The French Revolution, which came right after the American Revolution, was rooted in Rousseau, in Rousseauian ideas. Now, mind you, without Rousseau, you do not get Karl Marx. You have to understand this. Without Rousseau, you do not get some of these other leftist thinkers. And Rousseau argued in a very clear sense that private property, the ownership of private property, was one of the main roots of all evil. And again, we are going to get into this deep philosophy, and we're going to connect it to modern day time, which I think is so important, because there's some big questions that I want to answer in this show, and that every day we're going to revisit, which one of the big questions I want to visit with my audience and you guys listening is, can the United States be preserved in its original form? And then secondly, how do we do that? What is the way that we actually are able to preserve this republic? So Rousseau argued that the ownership of private property was one of the roots of all evil, that we must think of the collective first, not as the individual first. Now, the French Revolution versus the American Revolution, you can see the difference there. The French Revolution was that we must think of we all together must own these things. The American Revolution was the individual, the sovereignty of the person matters the most. And you can see that is enshrined in the American Bill of Rights. And so when I talk about that I'm a conservatarian and I talk about why I believe what I believe, it is everyone listening to this podcast, I believe that you can live an even better life tomorrow, next month, next year than you are today. I believe that the biggest thing that can get in your way is a government telling you how to live, telling you what to do, and a government taking your money away. That individuals should have the moral capacity to flourish. That let me rephrase that. That you should have the moral decisions to make in your life. That it, in fact, it is moral for you to be able to flourish and to attain that level of prosperity and to be able to go to heights that you never deemed imaginable. So we're gonna, in a moment, we're gonna get into the American Trinity versus the leftist Trinity and really go into the core underpinnings of what it means to be an American and the ideas that are enshrined in our founding documents and the founding fathers. But before we do that, as all of you know, May is essentially the big season for sports. You got the NHL playoffs, you got the NBA playoffs, you got Major League Baseball, go Cubs, and many more. There's a ton of action, but there's only one place that has you covered and only one place that we trust to actually place the bets that matter, and that is betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use that promo code podcast1 for your 50% welcome bonus. You know, I love seeing individuals compete in athletics at the very highest level. Now, mind you, if someone could please beat the Golden State Warriors, that would be so fulfilling to me. It just seems that there's nothing good that happens out of this sort of NBA climate. But kind of seeing Golden State go against Houston, I just love seeing the James Harden versus Kevin Durant dynamic, these former teammates now in this really amazing setting. Love it. However, it's kind of evident that I think Golden State will prevail. But if you want to actually place a bet for or against Golden State, you can do so by going to betonline.ag. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get in on the action. Don't forget to use that promo code podcast1 or text BETNOW. That's bet now to 238-669 to receive a 50% welcome bonus. Again, that is betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts. So we will get to some bold 2020 predictions very soon, talking about the Democrat field observations. But if you're involved in politics and you're involved in this fight, it is necessary. In fact, it is imperative that you understand the philosophy behind it. Politics is nothing more than the exercise of values and philosophy. That's all politics is. Philosophy is the underpinnings of all of our modern day politics. Understanding the thinkers that formed the modern American left. And we're going to go through that every single week here on the Charlie Kirk Show. And if, by the way, if you're listening to this and you like what you're hearing, please give us 5 stars. Really, really helps us out. The liberal trolls are trying to delist us. But we're going to go through this every single week. We're going to talk about Socrates to Plato to Aristotle, and I'm going to try to make it as digestible as possible and connect it to the modern American conservative movement, connect it to the public policy debates that we're having, connect it to everything that's happening. So what does it actually mean to be an American? I hear this all the time. People say, well, Charlie, there's nothing unique about the American culture. Charlie, there's nothing that is exceptional about America. Now, America is not just the richest country, not just the greatest country, not just the most productive country because of our amazing natural resources, which, praise God, we have amazing natural resources in this country. We have more natural gas than almost any other nation. We have more oil reserves. We have more coal. We have an amazing amount of land, especially thanks to the great state of Alaska. If you're listening out there, please shoot me a message. We'd love to shout you out. Alaska is one of my favorite states, especially this time of year. We're not just prosperous and productive because that we're surrounded by allies, Mexico and Canada. We're not just prosperous and productive because we're surrounded by two bodies of water. No. We're also not just prosperous and productive because we have a bunch of people. Because if just the amount of people mattered, India would be the wealthiest country in the world. If natural resources just mattered, Russia would be the richest and most productive country in the world. If just being surrounded by allies mattered, Australia would be the richest and most productive country because they're surrounded by water. The reason we are the most productive and generous and benevolent and entrepreneurial and forward-thinking country ever to exist is because of our ideas. Ideas matter. Philosophy matters. So the philosophy that is embedded and enshrined in the American Constitution and in our founding documents and put forth by our founding fathers is still allowing us to prosper to this day. So one of my great mentors and heroes, Dennis Prager, has this amazing example. I'm going to add on to it and hopefully give it a bigger platform because I think it's such an incredible example that does not actually get a big enough platform. So he argues that there is an American Trinity, just like there's a Christian Trinity. So in the Christian Trinity, we believe that there is God in three parts. There is God as the Son, God as the Father, and God as the Holy Spirit. So the way that we think of it and we explain it in Christianity is that all three are equal parts of God, but think of it as water. So you could drink water, you have water in the air, and you could also have water as an ice cube. So water can be in three different parts. H2O can be in three different parts. The same as God the Father, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. But there is an American Trinity. I'm going to walk through the three parts of the American Trinity and why they matter and how incredible they are. Then I'm going to juxtapose it with what right now is happening with the leftists right now, and they actually have their own Trinity. So the first pillar of the American Trinity is the Latin phrase E pluribus unum, which means out of many one. Now, this is actually on the American presidential seal. This was one of the phrases the founding fathers repeated, and they put on many of our founding documents and many of our founding monuments. Now, what does that mean? It means out of many one, that Latin phrase, e pluribus unum. But think about it. It's the first civilization and country and culture ever founded in human history that focused on unity, not on division. Almost any other country and culture that was ever formed was us versus them. It was factions. It was regionalized. It was creating people against each other. The founding fathers said, what phrase can we put into our documents, into our ideas that is focused on unity? Now, mind you, the founding fathers did not totally live up to their own ideals. No person ever would or never will. Many of the founding fathers owned slaves. So they actually did not live up to this idea of e pluribus unum, but they sure did chart us on the correct direction towards this idea of being out of many one, that there is only one race, the human race. It's kind of this old phrase that you hear growing up, we're all in this together, right? That we must focus on what unites us and what puts us together, that the only thing that could ever break down this greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world, this great blessing that has been given us, is if the country separates itself apart, that you get factions and you get division. And this was actually warned against in one of the Federalist Papers, was talking about the dangers of factions. And this was Federalist 10, written by James Madison, the fourth American president, where he talked about the dangers of factions, where I'm going to read for quote in Federalist number 10, by a faction I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest adverse to the rights of other citizens. So essentially, he talked about that there could possibly be these factions that unite. And this is where they said the importance of having the idea of e pluribus unum comes from. The second part of the American Trinity is liberty, which means that you can do what you want to do, how you want to do it, free of government intrusion. But you must take responsibility for yourself if that liberty leads you in a direction you did not think it would. Yes, you can start that business, and yes, you can keep the profits if you succeed, but you also have to take responsibility if that business does not succeed. Yes, you're able to get married to whomever you see fit, However, if that marriage falls apart, you have to take responsibility for that marriage. Yes, you can drink what you want to drink, but drink responsibly, remember? Because you have to be responsible for your own actions. This is inherent and embedded in the Founding Fathers' documents and writing all throughout the Federalist Papers, which is, we will protect your liberty. We will protect your natural rights upon your birth. This is so important that your rights come from God. They don't come from government. That your rights are enshrined upon your creation. The only thing that government could possibly do is take those rights away from you. Government did not give you those rights, but government exists to protect those rights for you through the court system. Now, the idea of liberty is so unique. You have to understand that most human beings had no idea what liberty was back then. Back when the Founding Fathers actually wrote the American Constitution, and before that they wrote the Declaration of Independence, most people knew nothing except living under a ruler. Now, the Americans were different, the then colonies of then America, because they were actually very rebellious folks. Most of the culture of the colonies of America back then were religious freedom seekers. Almost all the colonies that were formed were colonies of religious freedom. Most of the people that fled were fleeing religious persecution. They were fleeing the monarchy that did not allow them to have the liberty and the freedom to be able to express themselves as they saw fit religiously. So this idea of liberty is fundamental. Now, mind you, it relates very well to younger audiences. At Turning Point USA, we rarely find students that say, oh, I don't want to be free. I don't want to have liberty. No, we find all the time that students actually want to be free and that they want to have liberty. However, the second part of it, that you have to take responsibility for your life, that you have to take responsibility for your actions, that's a lot more difficult. What you're trying to say, I have to wake up earlier, you're trying to say that I have to maybe take a second job, that's difficult. But that is inherent and embedded in liberty. And the third part of the American Trinity is the phrase, in God we trust. It's on almost all of our currency. It's on many of our monuments in Washington, D.C. It's on many of the official seals of Congress, that phrase, in God we trust. That goes back to this idea of natural rights. John Locke talked about it. David Hume talked about it. Adam Smith talked about it. That your rights, as articulated in the Bill of Rights, mind you, in the United States Constitution, the rights to expression, the right to self-defense, the right to privacy, the right to due process, they are given by God, not by government. They must be preserved, understood, and protected. Now, mind you, just because you say in God we trust does not necessarily mean you even have to believe in a God. Now, I do. Most of the Founding Fathers were a form of deists. They were appreciative of Christianity in one form or fashion. But you should recognize that it is God, not government, that we should put our trust in. And this is so important because we as Americans look vertically where most countries look horizontally. We look vertically. We look upwards to a higher power, that there's something bigger than us, that there's a creator that has put us down here, that we have the humility that there's an omnipotent, omniscient, all-powerful creator that has the capacity and the power to change anything that he sees fit. And I think it is so important to realize that if we lose our appreciation for that higher power in our country, we're also going to lose a lot of the philosophical underpinnings of exactly how we are able to get where we are today and the excellence that we are able to pursue. So these are the three parts of the American Trinity. Now, mind you, all three of those parts are in the greatest document ever to exist, the American Constitution. Now, I want you to understand, the American Constitution was the first time in human history where the winners of a war voluntarily gave up political power. Do you think Napoleon Bonaparte voluntarily gave up political power? Do you think Alexander the Great voluntarily gave up political power after a war? You think Genghis Khan gave up power after a war? You think the great military conquerors in human history said, oh, we won this great battle. Now let's form a republic and give all the power back to the people. You think Julius Caesar, after he won some of the great military conquests, all of a sudden wanted to put Rome back to a republic? No, he kept it as an empire and he was killed because of it. Mind you, Rome never went back to being a republic after it became an empire. It became an empire and then it fell apart. But the Founding Fathers made a conscious and deliberate and humble decision that changed human history forever. They won a war, and then they gave the power back to the very people that helped them win the war, that they fought the war for. They could have created the Pennsylvania monarchy of Benjamin Franklin. they could have created the Commonwealth of Virginia as overseen by the Washingtonians. They could have divided the spoils, if you will, amongst all the generals and all the thinkers of their time. Paul Revere could have had Maryland, for goodness sakes. You know, they could have been the richest people imaginable, yet the United States Constitution was the first time that someone won a war and they said, you know what? We are flawed human beings. We are broken. This is a very, by the way, this idea of being broken by nature, this comes from the Bible, the idea of original sin, but it's also articulated by Hobbes, and we'll get into Hobbes in many future episodes, but it's very, very deep philosophy talking about human beings are self-interested. They are greedy. They are envious. They are duplicitous by nature. So the founding fathers realized that, wait, if we're all that way, why would we give ourselves all that power? Because we're just going to break it. We're going to screw it up. So they decided to create a constitutional republic, not a democracy, but a constitutional republic with certain unalienable rights and certain recognition of those rights that are protected and preserved in the Bill of Rights. Now, they never tried to create utopia. They never tried to create perfection. Instead, they try to create something that was excellent. There's a huge difference with this because the left always tries to create utopia. They always try to create the absolute perfect thing. We're going to solve all the problems. Founding fathers never said that. They never said that in the Federalist Papers. You read Federalist 51, you read Federalist 10, Federalist 51, which, by the way, is one of the great Federalist Papers. They don't teach this in our schools. They don't teach this in our schools. They need to teach this. It's one of the great documents of why the Founding Fathers actually built the construct the way they did. And actually, the Anti-Federalist Papers are equally as compelling, not as popular, of course, because they didn't win. But if you actually go down to the humility of the Founding Fathers, George Washington could have been king for life. He could have been president of the colonies, president of America, and human beings would have known no different. But the decision, the conscious decision that the Founding Fathers made to give up political power is one of the reasons why we live free in this country today, and most of the other countries that have copied and duplicated our Constitution almost word for word also live free today. Now, in just a second, I'm going to get to the leftist trinity and some of the other underpinnings of what makes America the greatest country in the history of the world. And now the leftist trinity, which is the absolute opposite of the foundational American trinity. Now, instead of e pluribus unum, which means out of many one, it is divide and conquer. It is pinning people against each other. It is actually turning rich versus poor and men versus women and police versus citizens. It is pinning people against each other. Now, mind you, all of this philosophy that I'm talking about will make you a better predictor and understander of the daily news cycle. If you understand natural rights, if you understand the leftist trinity, you'll all of a sudden be able to say, wow, I understand what Joe Biden is doing here. I understand what Pete Buttigieg is doing here. I understand what Cory Booker is doing here, because these ideas don't change. The ideas of the leftist trinity versus the American trinity, natural rights, Rousseau and Hobbes, all this stuff will repeat itself, and it's repeat itself in the 2020 election. But think about it. In the leftist trinity, the American trinity, out of many one, leftist trinity, divide and conquer. Now, the second pillar of the leftist trinity, kind of juxtaposed with the American trinity, it's not about liberty. Think about it. It's about control. Do you actually think for yourself for at any point in any time that any policy that the Democrats running for president right now, they actually want to expand the liberty and freedoms for any individual? Think about that. Green New Deal, higher taxes, Medicare for all. It's about control. It's about controlling your decisions. And by definition, the more control government has, the less freedom, the less liberty, the less capacity you have as an individual to actually be able to make the choices that you see fit for yourself. So you look at this. Liberty is tough, folks. Liberty is hard because you're going to have inequality. You're going to have winners. And yes, you're going to have losers. This is why you have to have ethics and you have to have charity and benevolence, because there will be people that don't succeed when you have liberty. If you want control, if you want the absolute form of control to have someone be able to dictate for you what you want to see fit, that's not a lot of fun. There won't be a lot of flourishing. There won't be a lot of prosperity embedded in that. But you'll definitely have the comfort that someone else can make decisions for you. And I guarantee most people listening to this will say, well, I don't believe in control. I don't want control. Well, what do you think Medicare for all is? What do you think having the government control your healthcare decisions are, when there's only a certain set of doctors that you can use and only a certain set of doctors that you can choose? And then finally, in the leftist trinity, it is not in God we trust at all. It's in government we trust. Every single solution that the left has proposed to this day is growing government. Government will solve that problem. Government will be the answer to our problems. Government will be the one that comes and administers the inequality in the way that we see fit. It is not people that are going to be able to solve these problems. It's not entrepreneurs. It's not businesses. No. Business is a problem. It is government. And somehow, in their view, government's never done anything wrong. But we as conservatives, we as conservatarians, we as libertarians, we as independents, whatever you want to call yourself, Republican, whatever, American, we are inherently skeptical towards government. This is something the founding fathers understood. This is something that we as Americans should always be skeptical of power. You should be skeptical of big companies. You should be skeptical of big institutions and 100% skeptical of big government, because big government inherently, their incentive structure is to come and encroach on the freedoms and liberties of the individual. And the two other dynamics that I really want to talk about is the idea of being a victim versus a victor. This is so important. Because right now, the entire left, the entire American left, is glorifying and glamorizing victimhood. There is no other reason why Jussie Smollett would pretend, essentially make up a hate crime in the middle of the night in -2-degree weather in Chicago if he did not think there would be virtue in him becoming a victim. If he did not think that all of a sudden he would get more attention, that he would get more fan mail, that he would get on TV more. If he did not think he could play the victim, well, feel bad for me. There's something admirable, right, in being the victim. Of course there isn't. The American story is a story of being a victor. It's the story of the Irish immigrants fleeing famine with nothing and coming to America and applying themselves and enjoying freedom and liberty. And 10, 15, 20, 50 years later, being able to say our lives are better today than they were 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. It's being a victor. Every human being listening to this show right now, every person listening to this will have difficulty. Life is suffering. There's two ways you can deal with suffering. You can complain about it and blame someone else for your problems, or you can reapply yourself and ask introspectively, how am I going to become a better person to overcome that struggle? And mind you, that is hard. Our education system is wiring students, and it is wiring people, and it's programming them to blame others. No matter what the problem is, no matter what the issue is, well, wealth inequality, must be rich people. That's the reason it's happening. Well, I'm not succeeding the way I want to. Well, it's got to be somebody else's fault. There's got to be institutional bias or prejudice against you. And there might be some merit to those arguments, but are you doing everything you possibly can to apply yourself? If you want to change the world, change yourself. If you want to change the world, change yourself. Wake up earlier. In the words of the great Jordan Peterson, make your bed, do something better with your life. Don't just blame somebody else for it. And then finally, there's two big ways to interpret your existence here in America. Two big ways. You could be angry that you live in America or thankful that you live in America. This is the difference right now politically. The entire American left is angry that they're in America right now. I mean, do you see any of these people running for president right now? Do you get any idea that they're really thankful that they live here? I mean, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, can you just say one nice thing about America, please? I'm going to issue a challenge. Can you say one nice thing? Just one. Can you just say a nice thing about America? I mean, every one of these folks running for president, Kamala Harris, we live in a racist and bigoted and sexist, homophobic country. Why do you want to be president of a country like that? That sounds like a horrible place. And the other way is to be thankful. Now, just because you're thankful for something, conservatives are, and the data shows this, are much more likely to be thankful that they live in America, are much more likely to be appreciative that they are living in this amazing American experiment. And because they're thankful that they live in America, they want to preserve and protect it. They want to fight for it. They want to conserve it. That is embedded in actually the word conservatism and conservative. But if you're angry that you live in America, then all of a sudden you want to overthrow, you want to destabilize and deconstruct. And that is one of the great paradigms happening today in America. Because doesn't it seem that there is an immense amount of anger, especially amongst the radical left, juxtaposed with those people that are conservatives that want to preserve and that are thankful that you have this blessing? I believe that gratitude is the fruit that makes all other things taste sweet. It is the thing that if you have gratitude, if you have appreciation, if you're thankful for something, then all other good virtues come after that. Whereas you're angry with something, if you have the lack of gratitude, the lack of thankfulness, not so much is the case. So we're about to get to our big 2020 predictions and analysis of the field. But first, 2020 is going to be the most important election in our nation's history. Seriously. President Trump and the RNC have already posted record fundraising numbers and assembled an outstanding staff. But now they're asking for your help to build the winning grassroots support network. Text CHARLIE to 88022 and receive official Trump alerts directly to your phone. I get these all the time, by the way. They are when they have rallies, when there's big news, when they need certain things pushed out. You guys have to sign up. You'll gain exclusive insight from President Trump himself, be the first to know when Trump merchandise is available, and you'll even be able to give your input on key issues to help shape the 2020 campaign. I know the leadership of the Trump campaign. They read these. They love to hear from the grassroots. All you have to do is text CHARLIE to 88022. Look, we all know by now that the mainstream media will never be honest about President Trump and Republicans. Make sure you're getting your news directly from the source by texting CHARLIE to 88022. Again, be sure to text CHARLIE to 88022 today. This is paid for by the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, a joint fundraising committee authorized by and composed of Donald J. Trump for President, Inc., and the Republican National Committee that is dedicated to making America great again. All right, as all of you are watching this 2020 circus on the Democrat side, everything that I talked about leading up to this point in the show will hopefully help you be more informed and better understanding exactly how the left operates and how you're able to predict it. And every single week, we're going to be able to analyze the timeless ideas that have built this country, understanding them, and then also talking about the news of the today, talking about actually what's going on with people running for office and what's going on in politics. And so if I had to actually distill what's going on right now in the 2020 primary election with the Democrats, I get asked this question all the time. CHARLIE, who's the nominee going to be? Look, I don't know, but I can predict it as if I have some sort of, you know, inside information. If there's any place I don't have inside information, it's definitely not within the Democrat primary, okay? But I can say this. I can read trends. I understand political history better than most, and I can kind of tell you what's going on. So typically, people in politics look for inverses. So Trump was the anti-Obama. Everything about Trump was anti-Obama. Obama came out of nowhere. No one had heard of him before. Trump had been around for many, many decades. Obama apologized for America. Trump had unapologetic defense for America. Completely and totally different. Now, who would be the anti-Trump? Well, right now, the anti-Trump is Buttigieg. I mean, literally, he's right out of central casting. I could just imagine right in L.A., right? You know, they're kind of sitting around and he's got Scorsese, you got Spielberg, you got Quentin Tarantino. And they say, well, so how are we going to beat this Trump guy? And Tarantino kind of puts his hands up and he kind of does the director's thing. He says, how about a veteran from the Midwest? And then Scorsese cuts in, yes. And he's got to be gay because then we can unite the coast around it. And then Spielberg interrupts, how about a mayor? A mayor, because he's kind of in charge, but he's a man of the people. And he's from the Midwest because the Midwest folks love that. And then of course, you know, another executive producer chimes in, maybe, you know, Scorsese says, but he also went to Harvard because he's got the credibility. So he's a veteran, he's a mayor, and he's young. See, literally out of central casting. And look, he's an American veteran, therefore he's an American hero. I totally appreciate his service, not demeaning him. But if you actually archetypically try to create someone out of Hollywood central casting, this is Pete Buttigieg. And the research I've done about his background has shown that he was somewhat of an ineffective mayor, but I think that's going to come out in many weeks and months to come. But he's definitely generating energy, and he's tapping into something. He's tapping into something in the Democrat base because they see him as literally the exact opposite of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is authoritative. Donald Trump is able to command the media news cycle and attack him. Pete Buttigieg comes at it from a very unassuming way. And so he's able to really build off of that and try to be the inverse. Now, I think actually Trump would beat him in a very declarative, very decisive victory, I should say. And so if you actually look at who is succeeding on the 2020 cycle right now, it's really hard to tell. Like, these polls, I don't think they mean much of anything. These polls have never been correct. These polls have never been predictive. But here's the thing about Biden. You know, people always ask about Biden. The first thing is he's the first major presidential candidate in my lifetime, and I think in U.S. history, and anyone can correct me, to actually pretend that he's more radical than he really is. He's trying to convince people that he's actually more radical. If there's an issue, Joe Biden has been on every single side of that issue, no matter what it possibly is. You know, he's been kind of for abortion rights, and now he's for abortion rights, and before he was for restricted abortion rights. I mean, so let's just use the example of Anita Hill. In 1998, then Senator Joe Biden admitted to Arlen Specter, he said, quote, "It was clear to me that from the way that she was answering the questions, Anita Hill was lying." Wow, okay. That was published in Specter's 2000 memoir. Now in 2019, good old Uncle Joe says, "Not only didn't I vote for Clarence Thomas, I believed her from the beginning. I was against Clarence Thomas. I did everything in my power to defeat Clarence Thomas, and he's won by the smallest margin anyone ever won going on the Supreme Court." First of all, that's just not true, okay? Brett Kavanaugh had the smallest margin anyone was going on the Supreme Court, so thanks for that Senate history, Joe Biden. Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed on the Supreme Court with a vote of 50 to 49. I think Clarence Thomas was 54 or 55 votes. 54 votes. So it's just factually incorrect, Uncle Joe, but don't let facts get in the way of a good narrative. But no matter what the issue is, no matter what the topic is, Joe Biden has been on every single issue. 1974, Joe Biden once said that, quote, "When it comes to civil rights and civil liberties, I'm a liberal, but that's it. I'm really quite conservative on most other issues." Are you kidding me? In 1974, Joe Biden said, quote, "I'm really quite conservative on most other issues." In 2019, "I'm told I get criticized by the, quote, new left. Quote, I have the most progressive record of anyone running for president and anybody who would run." Now, listen, Joe, if you're going to try to out-socialist Bernie Sanders, you are going to lose. If you are going to try to be, "I'm the most socialist guy running," or "Whose socialist is it anyway?" some new kind of variation of it, you will lose to Elizabeth Warren. You will lose to Cory Booker. You will lose to Bernie Sanders. Run on actually being a centrist who can solve problems. Run as a centrist who can bring people together. Instead, when you said, quote, "I'm a liberal, but that's it. I'm really quite conservative on most other issues," in 1974. I can't wait to see how that plays in a Democrat primary, right, Mr. Producer? I just can't wait to see how that works. And on every single, I'll give you one more example. Every single level of the issue, Joe Biden has been for, he's been against. Even when it comes to segregation, at one point, Joe Biden argued for segregation. He's now trying to be this great civil rights candidate. He literally eulogized Robert Byrd, who was the former KKK leader, Democrat. Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden were really good friends with him, former senator, KKK leader. No matter what the issue is, Joe Biden has been on either side of the issue. I'll give you one more example. Free college, 1987. By the time Biden first ran for president in 1987, he'd adopted much of Reagan's anti-government message in his pitch to Democratic voters. What? Joe Biden is an opportunist. He only does what the sway of the American people want. And right now, in order to get the Democrat nomination, he has to try to re-radicalize himself. He has to try to camouflage himself and try to make himself some sort of political amphibian to convince people that he's really this social justice progressive. He said, quote, in 1987, "Government can do many things, but in the final analysis, government can act a little more than as a catalyst." Biden said this on the stump. "We must demand more of ourselves, our managers, our workers, our consumers, are needed to change their attitudes in order to revitalize this society." Thanks, conservative Uncle Joe. I mean, I agree with 1987 Joe Biden, who says we need to do more for ourselves. You know, what a message. Now in 2015, Joe Biden, "We need to commit to 16 years of free public education for all of our children. We all know that 12 years of public education is not enough. As a nation, let's make the same commitment to a college education today that we made to a high school education 100 years ago." Well, that's really interesting. I mean, he has been on literally two sides of every single issue. And here's another interesting one, 1975, because this is now a big one for reparations. Everyone talks about reparations, reparations, reparations. And I got actually some very interesting questions about reparations. And so here, reparations, 1975, Joe Biden, "I don't feel responsible for the sins of my father and grandfather. I feel responsible for what the situation is today, for the sins of my own generation. And I'll be damned if I feel responsible to pay for what happened 300 years ago." Joe, you have lost a Democrat primary if that is your current position. I'm telling you right now. I want to reread this. If I said this, if Charlie Kirk said it this way, I would be in trouble, okay? He is a Democrat, said this. I got to reread this again. "I don't feel responsible for the sins of my father and grandfather. I feel responsible for what the situation is today." Pounding his fist, you get to see him pound with this. "For the sins of my own generation. And I'll be damned if I feel responsible to pay for what happened 300 years ago. 2019, we don't have a comment yet from the vice president on reparations. We need a comment from you, Vice President Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden. Now, by the way, with this reparations thing, America's made some horrible mistakes. I will admit it. We have some huge sins, and we should atone for those sins, the people that actually did them. I don't think there's any people that own slaves that are alive today, but if there are, they should go to prison for that horrible, horrible crime. But as far as the slave ownership discussion and the reparations discussion, I have some very important questions. First of all, what happens if you're half, like you're mixed race? Do you get like half the money if, you know, your ancestors on one side were slaves, but the ancestors on the other side own slaves? So do you pay yourself? How does that work? Do you kind of like have to send money to yourself? Candace Owens, who I've worked with at Turning Point USA for a long time, dear friend, made a great point. This is her point, not Charlie Kirk saying it, because I'm going to just say what she said. She said, wait a second. The Democrats have tried to tell us for years that it is racist to demand that anyone should have voter ID, that anyone should have voter ID. Yet somehow, in some miracle, the black community is now going to be able to prove their ancestry 8 generations ago. If you can't, if all of a sudden it's racist to demand voter ID, what is it to demand that they have to prove their ancestry? Don't you have to have voter ID to prove your ancestry? Again, that's Candace Owens' argument. I just think it's quite comical and something that we should talk about. This idea of reparations is so silly and is so stupid. Almost every group that has come here to America fled persecution. They fled something horrible that happened to them. You know, 10,000 Asian Americans worked on the Transcontinental Railroad? 10,000 Americans in a form of slavery. They built the Transcontinental Railroad with subpar wages, with brutal beatings, with working throughout the night, people dying working on the railroad, a form of slavery. 10,000 Asian Americans, Chinese Americans mostly. We put Japanese Americans in internment camps in the 1940s. America is not without sin, but is the right way to go about addressing that sin, going back and trying to redistribute goods and services today to something that no one today actually lived through? I think it's nothing more than just trying to divide and conquer, as we talked about early in the show. Remember, part of the leftist trinity is divide and conquer. So when you talk about that, who are they actually trying to divide and conquer? I'll let you lead to that conclusion yourself. We're going to get to some really big predictions for the 2020 cycle in the Democrat primary and some other big, bold predictions. But first, 2020 is going to be the most important election in our nation's history. Again, it's not even close. President Trump and the RNC have already posted record fundraising numbers and assembled an outstanding staff, but now they're asking for your help to build the winning grassroots support network. Text Charlie to 80810 and receive official Trump alerts directly to your phone. You'll gain exclusive 2020 updates directly from President Trump himself. Be the first to know when new Trump merchandise is available, and you'll even be able to have your input on key issues to help shape the 2020 campaign. Again, all you have to do is text Charlie to CHARLIE to 80810. Look, we all know that the mainstream media will never be honest about President Trump and Republicans. Make sure you're getting your news directly from the source by texting Charlie to 80810. Again, be sure to text Charlie to 80810 today. This was paid for by the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, a joint fundraising committee authorized by and composed of Donald J. Trump for President, Inc., and the Republican National Committee that is dedicated to making America great again. So I've been hinting at this the entire show about three bold predictions, and I kind of led into this nicely. Number one, Biden will not be the Democrat nominee. He just won't. And I could prove this to you. The center of gravity, the center of political energy, the center of enthusiasm and energy is not around Joe Biden right now. It's not. Now, he might be up in the polls. That doesn't mean anything. He has name recognition. The center of gravity is around Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Bernie Sanders, I mean, he has not been on the side of every single issue. If I have all this, I have pages, by the way, if you can hear the pages, I have pages, like an encyclopedia of Joe Biden being on one side of one issue and contradicting himself. You want free college? He's been on one side of that issue. You want felons? They should vote. They should go to prison for life. You got everything. You got Anita Hill. She's a liar. She's a great person. Abortion, pro-life, pro-choice, conservative, progressive, guns, you name it. Joe Biden's been on the side of every single issue. Bernie Sanders has been a Bolshevik his whole life. Bernie Sanders literally honeymooned in the Soviet Union, which actually horrifies me. I mean, you get married. It's the greatest time of your life. And you turn to your wife and you say, let's really go somewhere exciting. She says, yes. What do you have in mind, Bernard? Which is actually his name. How about Stalingrad? Yes, it sounds wonderful this time of year. And he actually saw the Soviet Union, which actually horrifies me, that anyone who saw the Soviet Union comes back with any form of socialism. But he saw something he did like there. What did he see? He didn't like the poverty. He didn't like the suffering. He didn't like the famine. He saw how well the elites lived, and he wanted to be one of them. He saw that through using political exploitation and failed promises that he could have total and complete control over a society, and somehow he could organize things effectively. But he's the center of political energy, not Joe Biden. Joe Biden will be devoured by the progressive machine. He'll be devoured by this progressive monster. I know this first importantly because of the work I do on college campuses. He violates sin numero uno, which he's a straight white man. Now, mind you, Bernie is too, but Bernie being a Bolshevik, breadline Bernie, he gets away with that for now. Well, but he'll be attacked eventually. Joe Biden has been on the side of every single issue. But here is my theory in practice, that the political energy is all around Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders says one of the stupidest political statements that I have heard in a very long time. At a CNN town hall, he gets asked the question, Senator Sanders, you have said many times that you think felons should be able to vote. Do you think that the Boston bomber should be able to vote from prison? And Senator Sanders says,
absolutely. I believe that they should be able to vote from prison. Let me be perfectly clear.
He makes this whole speech about how they should be able to. And the place applauds horrifyingly. I'll explain why this is a stupid, stupid position. There's no other word for it and why it's just not correct. And every other candidate after it says, oh yeah, me too. Yeah, Kamala Harris, 100% Booker, absolutely. Every other candidate did not dare to defy Bernie Sanders because they know that if they disagree with Bernie Sanders on one of these issues, the political energy, the political gravity will go away from them. Bernie Sanders is raising the most amount of small dollar donors. He has the most activists. He's drawing the biggest crowds. He has the most enthusiasm. He has the most energy. He is the standard bearer right now in the party. He is consistent. He is principled around these horrific ideas. It's not Joe Biden. They will deploy their progressive base against Joe Biden. There will be a time when Joe Biden has to sit down for a feature interview, and they're going to say, former Vice President Biden, thank you so much for being here.
You got it. Yeah.
They're going to say, so what do you think about abolishing the Electoral College?
Yeah,
I could live with that. Sure. What do you think about the Green New Deal? Great. Love the Green New Deal. Perfect. What do you think about terrorists voting from prison? Okay. Yeah, got it. That's fine. What do you think about confiscating all the guns? You lunatics, this is how we're going to lose the... He's going to snap. He is going to snap at some point because he always has. This guy has run for president multiple times. He is a walking gaffe machine. He's very emotional. He's going to snap on somebody. And he's going to say, what are you trying to lose this election? He's going to... Because he's from Scranton, Pennsylvania. He's not a radical Malibu or Manhattan progressive. He's just not. I have it here. I have an encyclopedia of show prep of every issue he's ever been on one side or the other. He's not that. He's going to pretend he is, and he's going to snap, and it will start one of the metaphorically bloodiest civil wars the Democrat Party has ever seen, because they want nothing more than defeat Donald Trump. They hate Donald Trump much more than they love America. The most important thing for them right now is defeating Donald Trump. The most important thing. But even more than that, they want somebody that they believe embodies their progressive socialist message. No PAC money, no corporate donor money. Sorry, Joe Biden, that disqualifies you. Can't be a straight white male. Sorry, Joe Biden, that disqualifies you. He authored the Clinton crime bill. He did all the things that they hate, and they are going to devour him because of it. Now, I have to kind of give an asterisk about this Bernie Sanders people voting from prison thing. So Bernie Sanders comes back and he says, well, we as a society have to be okay with even the worst people still participating in our democracy. And so it actually sounds good. Like for half a second, I was like, yeah, maybe that sounds good. And there were some libertarian articles that were written. Yes, Bernie Sanders is correct about terrorists voting from prison. And then I really thought about it. I said, well, wait a second. So the thought process behind Bernie Sanders is that your rights should not stop just because you go to prison. I'm like, huh, that sounds good, right? Wait, hold on a second. Of course they should. That's what prison is all about. You go to prison because you have violated our social contract. You violated the law. You violated somebody else's freedom of life. You violated somebody else's freedom to live, of consciousness. So we're taking freedoms away from you. Prison is the absence of freedom. Prison, you get 3 meals a day, you get a shower, and you get a bed. That is total and complete control. That everything you need, quote unquote, need, to live, you have, but you have no freedom. So let's play this out. Let's play this out as a thought exercise. Should we really not have prisoners? We should give them more rights? Should they be able to have a protest against the warden in the yard at any time they want? Organize and say, overthrow the warden? Should they be able, whenever they want, at any time, be able to have a sit-in against the prison guards because they're too oppressive? Should we, that's First Amendment rights. Second Amendment rights. Should we arm prisoners? Should we give them AR-15s? Should we give them firearms? Because that's a right, as enshrined in the Constitution. How about the Fourth Amendment? Should we be able to go into prisoners' cells to be able to search for contraband or for weapons or for plans of escape? Do we have a right to do that? The answer is, of course we do. The answer is, the whole idea of going to prison is you are giving up, you've given up freedom as soon as you committed the crime. As soon as you took someone's life away, like the Boston bomber, you have given that up. Now, I actually do support some form of felons outside of prison after they do their time, after they pay their debt to society, having a pathway to be able to vote again. I do believe that, because then your punishment is over. The time that you serve is over. But let me extrapolate this one point further. And somebody has to ask Bernie Sanders this question. Somebody does. So Senator Sanders, you think that prisoners should be able to vote because you don't want them to be absent outside of democracy? He'll say yes. Well, then should they be allowed to run for office while in prison? Because prisons make up the majority population in a lot of these rural towns. The prisons are 4,000, 5,000 people big in rural Montana or rural Wyoming. They put them there to help stimulate the economy, and they're in the middle. It's really hard to run away in rural Montana, right? Think about it. You run away, you're 100 miles, you're still in the middle of nowhere. So they put them in these rural areas, stimulates local economy where coal mines might have been shut down or lumber mills were shut down. So they put these federal prisons there in the middle of nowhere. So to Senator Sanders, should the Boston bomber be able to run for office? Can he run for mayor? Can he run for Congress, city council, state representative? Can they vote themselves out of office now? Can they have a referendum saying that, you know, this prison should be shut down? I'm not being facetious. I'm being deathly serious. His argument is that no one should be ever extracted outside of democracy. If you think someone can vote, you think they can run for office, by definition. If you want someone to have the same participatory capacity to involve themselves in a democracy, Bernie Sanders, then you're going to have prisoners running for office in rural Montana. Nothing will prevent them from doing it. And all of a sudden, you'll have them reconfiguring these small towns where there are 400 law-abiding citizens and 4,000 federal prisoners. That's the position of the new American Democrat Party. Joe Biden, I'd love to hear your stance on people voting from prison because we don't have one yet. Actually, maybe we do. No, my producer says we don't have one yet, but we will. We're going to have a position on all these different, we're going to have his position on all these sorts of things. That's my first one. Biden will not be the nominee. My second prediction, it's bold, very bold. I don't think the nominee is announced yet. I don't think the nominee of the Democrat Party is announced yet. This field feels incomplete. It feels that the political energy around Bernie Sanders has not totally completed itself, is that he is a straight white man, that yes, he is an avowed socialist. But I think that there's going to be a young AOC-style equivalent that's just going to come on and barnstorm this stage. It might not be someone who's qualified, but someone who's definitely charismatic, someone who understands social media, someone who can channel the Bernie Sanders energy and really connect the intersectional left together. I don't think that person has announced. Everything has changed. You can get hot so quickly. You can raise $5 million in 24 hours or less. You can become a household name within a week. Everything has changed. You don't need the institutional connections. You don't need the endorsements. None of that stuff matters anymore. You just need to be able to have the right message at the right time, announce, and strike at the correct time. Remember, at this time in 2015, in the election, Donald Trump had not yet elected for the presidency. He elected in mid-June for the presidency. Everything has changed. It's all about energy. It's about social media engagement. It's about virality. The old rules no longer apply. We are living in completely different political rules and engagement. You've heard it here first. I think the nominee is not yet announced. I think that there are people that have been waiting on the silence. People say, who do you think it is? Well, it could be Hillary. It could be Michelle Obama. It could be Oprah. It could be any of these people. Or it could be someone we've never heard of. It could be a self-made business person with a great socialist-style message that could do exactly what Bernie Sanders is talking about, but do it better, put some of their own money in it, and unite this party together in opposition of Donald Trump. And my third prediction, one that I've made publicly before, but I want to reinforce, that Donald Trump will be reelected as President of the United States in 2020. The economy is roaring. He's solidified his base. He has Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, 150 circuit court judges. He's moved the embassy to Jerusalem, canceled the Iran deal, defunded the Palestinian Authority, made America energy independent, the largest deregulation in American history, the largest American tax cut, signed the Veterans Accountability Act, signed Right to Try, signed prison reform, has urban revitalization, bringing jobs back to this country, 500,000 new manufacturing jobs, 6 million new jobs created since his election, 3.2% GDP growth. It is amazing to see the results that he's delivered. And if he actually delivers his report card back to the American people, he's at 51% approval rating under Rasmussen, which is amazing, which was the most accurate poll heading into the 2016 election, which was far above what Obama was at this time in his presidency at this very time. And I believe Donald Trump will be convincingly reelected. Because remember, it doesn't really matter how he does in New York. It doesn't matter how he does in California. He has to win just a collection of states. He has to win Arizona, Iowa, Wisconsin, Ohio, maybe Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, some collection of these. And I think the map is going to open up. I think there's going to be many, many paths to victory. I hear a lot of things from a lot of people in the American Southwest that immigration is the number one issue heading into the 2020 election. The New York Times just came out with an op-ed opinion piece that said, give Trump the money he wants for the border wall. All of a sudden, people are realizing this is a crisis on the southern border. 1 million people have crossed the southern border. They're going to cross the border this year. We're on pace for 1 million border crossers this year. 1 million border crossers. Two quick things. My producer informed me. I said Donald Trump Jr. was part of this administration. He's obviously not. He's part of the movement at large. So I want to correct myself. I also made some reference to amphibian animal or camouflage. Right, Mr. Producer? So I want to just correct myself there. I meant just saying that Joe Biden is a camouflage political figure. How about that? Chameleon. That's right. He's a camouflaged chameleon, right? Something like that. He changes colors. Everyone understands what I'm saying. I want to be precise. That's for you, Media Matters. I want to be very, very precise. I know you're watching. If you listen to this podcast, you like what you hear, this is just the beginning. I can go for hours and hours and hours. We just want to deliver this to you. We might be doing more episodes soon. We're going to be doing a surprise quick episode on Game of Thrones the day after the final Game of Thrones episode, dissecting all 8 seasons and the tropes and the characters and the ups and the downs, the greatest moments, the worst moments, things you might have heard. I was really blown away by this last episode. If you haven't heard it yet, please watch it. I'm not going to do spoiler alert for you right here, but please watch it. It's one of the greatest pieces of television I've ever seen, this last episode. These are like mini movies now. They're actually mini movies. They're absolutely amazing. And the writing and the conflict between characters is absolutely incredible. We're going to be doing a special show for that. If you're not yet involved with Turning Point USA, please get involved at tpusa.com, the nation's largest student movement fighting for free markets and limited government. And if you're listening to this and you like what you have to hear, please press that 5-star. Please press that 5-star. It helps us so much on Apple Podcasts. Those ratings mean more than you could ever imagine. And finally, if you like these products and you're using them, please shoot us a note. You can do it on Instagram. You can do it on Twitter. Just go to Charlie Kirk and send me the experience that you're doing. We'll give you a live shout out maybe on the show next week. I just want to thank all of our loyal listeners. This is our second show, but really the first episode we're able to dive deep. I hope you learned something. I hope you thought outside of the box. I hope you enjoyed it. We're going to be back next week with the Charlie Kirk Show. Please give us 5 stars and see you soon.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.